Hello, and thanks for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. In the aftermath of the referendum, Turkey has once again gone mad, but the show must go on. You can subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk to stay updated with the latest episodes. You can also find show notes and other links that you may find interesting by checking out the website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Don't forget there's a special deal for Turkey Book Talk podcast listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that offer, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address www.hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Basically, if you buy directly from Hearst, it's cheaper than Amazon, and perhaps more importantly, buying a book this way is a good way for you to help support this podcast. The offer includes sociologist Olivier Roy's new book, Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State, which I actually reviewed in Hurriyet Daily News last week. All the other books on the list, available at cut price, are written by authors who have previously appeared on this podcast. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, and Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter. So to order any of those titles for a third off, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. And if you do decide to buy, you'll be helping to support the Turkey Book Talk podcast. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is via my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. You can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But let's get on with this latest episode, and in it I speak to Mehmet Kurt. He's the author of a new book, Kurdish Hezbollah in Turkey, Islamism, Violence and the State, which has just been published by Pluto Press. And it really is a terrific book. The outlawed Kurdish Sunni Islamist militant group, not to be confused with the Lebanese Shiite militants of Hezbollah, is obviously far less written about than the PKK, but its influence on developments in southeast Turkey over the past few decades is very significant indeed. Mehmet Kurt's book describes the origins and development of Hezbollah through the 1980s and 90s. It's also enriched by the fact that Kurt himself has a personal interest in the subject. He was a student in Mardin in the 1990s at a religious Imam Hatip boarding school where Hezbollah was influential and where violence from Hezbollah-inspired students was commonplace. This personal connection gives him extraordinary access to dozens of Hezbollah members, past and present, and interviews with them give us an insight into a shady and little-known subject. I started by asking Mehmet Kurt to talk about how his background growing up prompted his interest in taking a deeper academic look at the subject.
Sure. I mean, as I said in the book, I graduated from Mardin İmam Hatip High School in 1999, but including the secondary school, I have spent 7 years in Mardin İmam Hatip High School, and I was a boarding school, so I was staying in the dormitory where the Hezbollah affiliated students were dominant. Of course, as a teenager, you cannot really explicitly give a meaning of what is happening and why there is an intense violence and this form of religiosity where the violence can be directed towards another emotive high school student who also would be considered as a religious person. And I studied theology after that, not a personal choice really. As you might know about the 28th of February postmodern coup in Turkey, we were kind of forced to study theology school as a part of this general regulation in the higher education system.
All Imam Hatip students had to apply to theology departments in university.
Yes, yes. And of course, after theology school, I changed my track. I studied sociology and anthropology. And at the time of my PhD, basically, I was thinking of what to study. And I thought, basically, my observations from those years can contribute a great value to academia in social science. And there wasn't any academic work on Kurdish Hezbollah, despite the fact that they are the second biggest political group in the Kurdish area in Turkey. And I assume there are several reasons for that. One of them is, of course, the group's underground activities for many years, for decades, and their secretive attitude towards outsiders. The security concerns, and obviously the access that people do not have. And being from the region, being able to speak Kurdish and Arabic, and of course studying theology and being aware of the Islamic terminology they are using, and knowing some people who can basically navigate through some informants. I managed to talk to many people, including some high rank members, former members, people who know them, who observed them. And as a result of that, I wrote my PhD on Kurdish Hezbollah. And now, basically, it's in the form of a book for the readership.
The roots of Hezbollah really go back to the 1970s and the local ideologue Hussein Veliolu from the province of Batman in the southeast. His network kind of developed in the 1980s, and it had this strong influence from Iran after the Iranian Revolution. And in the 1990s, its members were involved in a kind of all-out war, really, with rival religious groups, and of course with the PKK. Could you just talk a bit about those origins of Hezbollah and its development through the 1970s and 80s and 90s?
Officially, Hezbollah was founded in 1979 by five people, including Hüseyin Veliolu. If we look at Hüseyin Veliolu's background, we can see that he studied political science in Ankara University. And during those years, he was involved in some Islamist activities with Turkish Islamists. But somehow, he lost his hope that he can do anything with Turkish Islamists, although they have never stated their ethnical background for decades. Basically, he came back to Batman and he formed the Kurdish Hezbollah in 1979. It was a revolutionary group influenced by the Iran Islamic Revolution, and of course supported by them throughout 1980s. But back then there was many groups who were supported by Iran, and basically Hezbollah wasn't like the most accepted Islamist group supported by Iran by the end of 1980s. And of course the political violence in 1990s is another stage of these processes. And if we look at the activities and the geographical area they are basically active, we can see that there was an intense war and conflict between the Turkish security forces and the PKK. And obviously, many disagreements between Hezbollah and other Islamist groups, as well as the PKK, which resulted in kind of a communal conflict between Kurdish Hezbollah members and the PKK members. But we need to state that in 1990s, this conflict was supported, encouraged, and manipulated by the Turkish security forces and JITEM and the Turkish deep state, which resulted in the death of more than 1,000 people at least, and obviously much more communal harm, social harm in terms of social cohesion, in terms of trust in society, in terms of Kurdish people killing each other. And if we look at the figures in 1990s, we can see that Hezbollah members who committed crimes were not really prosecuted or arrested by Turkish security forces and by the justice system until 2000, when there was a police operation in a villa in Istanbul, Beykoz. And in that event, Hüseyin Veliolu was killed and the Hezbollah archive was seized by the Turkish forces. And after a few years of silence, basically Hezbollah reappeared in the form of civil society organizations. Later, also they have founded a political party, Hudapar, and at the moment, if we look at their activities, they have thousands of NGOs, dormitories, newspapers, magazines, TV channels, economical activities, a political party, some events like the blessed bird to celebrate Muhammad's birthday, and so on and so on. So now we are talking about this aspect, the legalized aspect of Hezbollah, but also there is an underground illegal part of it still active.
There has been this kind of legalization in recent years, but as you describe in the book, violence was really part of Hezbollah's modus operandi all along. And its vision from the moment it was founded really was to overthrow the secular Turkish state and establish a Sharia-based state. It may seem a bit obvious when we're talking about a militant group, but could you just explain the central role that violence played in Hezbollah during the years when it was active in the 80s and 90s?
Yes, true. I mean, first of all, Hezbollah was engaged in political violence and was utilized by different sources for many years. Although their aim was to overthrow the secular regime in Turkey, if we look at the numbers and the figures, they have almost never attacked any official state institution or any state officials. More basically, their violence was toward other Islamist group operating in the region, and later the PKK supporters and members and some other leftist groups, secular people. So then we need to question whether the modus operandi, the main reason of their existence, is really comply with their activities or not. My answer would be no. As we can see that they have never really attacked the state. And if we can locate them in a scale from the PKK to some other organizations, and on the other side, the Turkish state, I would say that they are closer to the Turkish state instead of really operating independently, especially at the time of conflicts, we can see that's where they stand.
And as you mentioned just before, one of the most common claims about Hezbollah during the 1990s, the early 90s particularly, is that it was set up or at least used by Turkish secret intelligence services against the PKK. And you explore this claim in the book. What do you make of that as a claim?
I do not claim that Hezbollah was funded by the state, but definitely the state has benefited from their presence in the region in the 1990s. They basically eased their activities and they closed an eye what they are doing. So when we look at their strategies and the aims and the violence towards particular people in the region, we can see that at least there is this unspoken alliance that we can elaborate on. And after studying about this group for many years, I can easily say that basically the Turkish state has benefited from their presence, but also they have benefited from this conflict in the area to expand their networks and to reach more people. And also, it's not a secret. Basically, they say this in one of the books, Candidil and then Hezbollah, saying that we didn't agree on anything with the Turkish state, but definitely Turkish state has benefited from our activities. So we can say that there is kind of this indirect confession that they also agree about this.
And what kind of cooperation would that be? Like, what kind of assistance would we be talking about?
I mean, to give a concrete answer, we need to think about how paramilitary groups operate in the world. And of course, there are many ways. Like usually the state or state institutions do not really interact with these kind of groups directly, but they have some mediators through intelligence, through local people. Also, basically, they infiltrate into these kind of groups through some certain members by bribery or offering things and so on and so on. Obviously, PKK was considered as the biggest threat in 1990s, and still probably, I mean, it's considered as the biggest threat by the Turkish state, I assume. And at the time like this, I think other groups are benefiting from this situation. Like, for example, at the moment, we can see this expansion of Hezbollah activities or Hezbollah-related organizations' activities, that when there are many NGOs being shut down by emergency decrees, we can see also an increase in their activities, as their weekly newspaper, Doğru Haber, is now a daily newspaper. They have more representation in public. And of course, they have a ground to basically organize their activities, political activities, is easier than other political groups.
Adding fuel to the claims of state cooperation is the fact that the security forces really only started focusing on Hezbollah in the late 1990s, and that's when it really started cracking down, after kind of basically leaving them alone through the early 90s, when it was really fighting against the PKK. And when they turned their attention to Hezbollah, there was a police raid in Istanbul that killed Hüseyin Veliolu, the leader of Hezbollah at the time, in 2000. And after then, thousands of Hezbollah members were jailed, and there was a kind of public shock, really, at some of the revelations that came out about torture and violence committed by Hezbollah through the 1990s. Could you just talk about that time and what exactly happened?
To be more specific, from 1991 to 1996, there was a conflict taking place between the PKK and Hezbollah. After 1996, there was a ceasefire between them that they didn't attack each other after this date. And Abdullah Öcalan was arrested in 1999. And just a year after that, I would conclude that Hezbollah wasn't a useful tool to the state anymore. And we can see the intensity of operations towards Hezbollah after this date, basically. After there wasn't a concrete violence taking place or committed by Hezbollah. So if we look at this inconsistency, we can see why this is happening. And in 2000, basically, after Hüseyin Veliolu was killed and the Hezbollah archive was seized by the state, we have seen all form of violence and torture as a part of this archive, although most of it is not released and probably won't be released at all. So 1990s obviously is a dark time of the Turkish history as well, where there was also unsolved murders, operations committed by JITEM, the Turkish deep state, and so on. So like, if we elaborate and analyze all of these dynamics together, I think it makes sense where Hezbollah stands and how the state has benefited from their presence. And obviously, as a small group operating in the region, likely they have felt that they need an ally after Iran stopped supporting them to exist and to survive in the region. So the violence between the PKK and Hezbollah was considered as a survival, the war of survival by Hezbollah. And that's why I think they increased the violence. Being a smaller group compared to the PKK, they probably felt that they need to be more violent to create this fear among people so they won't be touched.
And what about when the crackdown finally happened in 2000? What was the process behind that? Why did the police decide at that point to stage this raid? I think it was in a house in Beykoz in Istanbul. What was it behind that raid, and what happened in the months and years afterwards?
So Hüseyin Veliolu has just moved to Istanbul from Konya, and obviously the archive consisted of 100,000 pages of information, intelligence about people, about their members, videos, and all of this were in the house he was staying. It's still unclear why this operation has taken place. Many people say that there was actually a coincidence where police went to check the house after some information. And Hüseyin Veliolu and his friends fired back. They didn't allow the Turkish police in. And this is how operation started. And looking at the early hours of the operation being screened, broadcasted in the Turkish TVs live, we can see this confusion that actually people didn't know. The security forces also didn't know what's the operation about. Almost after a day, they have confirmed that it was the Hezbollah leader and the leadership subjected to the operation. But apart from that, if there is a clear reason or intention towards Hezbollah to basically kill Hüseyin Veliyoğlu or to arrest him by security forces, I would say that's also possible. But it's kind of a dark period of time that we cannot see what with which motivation this operation has taken place. But sooner or later, I think it was going to happen because Hezbollah wasn't a useful tool for the Turkish state anymore. And after that, what happened? Basically, through archives, security forces has managed to locate members of Hezbollah. We can see this huge wave of arrest and detention towards Hezbollah members, the leadership, but also the memberships. And ten thousands of people were arrested in the process. Some of them were not really involved in any violence, as they were a member of Hezbollah, just like doing activities in the mosques, teaching Quran or other religious texts, or being active in schools, high schools, or in universities, but not being a part of any violence. So many people were imprisoned because of the membership, but also more than 300 people were arrested with the accusation of killing more than one person. Most of them are still in prison at the moment.
And of course, in recent years, after that crackdown happened, there was the emergence of kind of legitimate legal groups that that basically carried the heritage of Hezbollah forward. And today, there's a legal political party, the Hudapar, which is a Kurdish Islamist party, which is legal and ostensibly non-violent. But it's basically the inheritor of Hezbollah. Could you just describe that process? I mean, there's NGOs that have emerged as well in recent years that are legal and legitimate. Could you just describe that process of how Hezbollah members have emerged in the kind of legal sphere in recent years?
After 2000, there was no chance to continue as an underground organization for Hezbollah, as their archive was seized and all of the ranks, the leadership ranks were known by the state, all memberships were known. So it would be very difficult for Hezbollah to operate as an underground organization only. But also, many Hezbollah members have noticed the violent part of Hezbollah after 2000. So people who were involved in Hezbollah activities were not really eager to continue their membership and their support as long as Hezbollah stay as an underground organization. But at the same time, especially with the European Union membership, the Turkey-EU membership process, we can see a huge support on civil society where small Islamic circles, Islamist groups, and Islamic communities started to organize their activities through civil society organizations. And Hezbollah has done the same. First appeared as Mustazaflar Derneği, but later they have initiated thousands of different civil society organizations. And after the closure of Mustazaflar, basically they have decided to initiate a political party. Although their final aim was initiating a political party, it wasn't the time that they were expecting to do it in 2012. But it was kind of a response to the closure of the biggest Hezbollah-affiliated association, Mustazaflar Derneği, although it was reopened a year after. So I would say that the political mobilization in the region is a result of basically the civil society aspect of the society, and it's not really specific to Hezbollah, as today we can see thousands of other Islamist NGOs and civil society organizations operating in the region. And of course, they have benefited from the presence of AK Party as well, as a conservative party. Basically, for the first time, I would say Islamic communities and Islamist groups who prefer to remain unknown and underground had a confidence to organize their activities and legalize their activities and appear in public places. And of course, this has provided them a great opportunity to reach more people and to be more present in public places.
Also, another factor that's had a big impact is the civil war in Syria. With the emergence of ISIS, this has had quite huge ramifications in Turkey in terms of exacerbating some of the fault lines in society, and particularly in the Kurdish region as well. Of course, in Syria, there are PKK-affiliated groups that are fighting against ISIS, and that has kind of spilled over into Turkey as well, because a lot of the fighters that have crossed over from Turkey to fight for ISIS are actually Kurdish citizens. So you've got this kind of fault line across the border in Syria spilling over into Turkey. And that's also been expressed in some ways by this new tension, this new that sometimes erupts in violence between PKK-affiliated youth groups in the southeast and groups that the PKK says are affiliated with Hezbollah, but also have like ISIS sympathies. That's the accusation anyway. Could you just talk a bit about that effect of ISIS? Like, how has Hezbollah been kind of squeezed between the PKK and its accusations that its members are ISIS sympathizers or even ISIS members?
Definitely, the civil war in Syria and the proxy war in Syria has a great influence in radicalization processes of all sorts of Islamist groups operating not only in Turkish-Syrian border in the southeast, eastern Turkey, but in all Turkey. But obviously, it has more effect on Hezbollah than other groups, I would say. So to state it clearly, Hezbollah has never supported the Syrian war, and they preferred not to be involved in the Syrian war. But Hezbollah has lost hundreds of young members who basically were considering this silence and this passive attitude bad, and they have participated in other radical groups such as ISIS or Al-Nusra and other groups, and they're affiliate in Turkey as well. So, for example, there is this one figure, Ebu Hanzala, who organizes classes, religious classes. He has a YouTube channel, magazines, journals, and several times he was detained with the accusation of being the leader of ISIS in Turkey. Recently, he was released. And this person is the son of one of the former Hezbollah leaders. And basically, many former Hezbollah members are now gathering around this person. Not only them, but also other radical groups. So I would say that Syria was a milestone for the radicalization of Islamist groups in the Middle East. And obviously, the general understanding of Islamism has arrived to a point that couldn't really produce any solution to a political situation because of many complexities, but especially after Muslim Brotherhood was overthrown in Egypt, and after the failure of the Arab Spring, basically Islamism has lost the ground, and it has led to a more radical form of Salafism, I would say. And now Hezbollah is kind of stuck in between whether to take a side on this violence to keep their young members, or whether to stay away from it and focus on their legal political activities. They mainly preferred the second, but especially during the Kobani protests, the PKK supporters and the protesters have attacked some Hezbollah-affiliated civil society organizations, and they have brutally murdered some young members of Hezbollah, like Yasin Börü and some other people. And this has led to a bigger tension between Hezbollah and the PKK again, as we could see in the process of June election. And after that, some Hezbollah members with the name of Sheikh Said Seriyeleri or İm Batman Hüseyin'in Fedaileri, they have come out, they have taken arms up in the streets, and basically they have killed several PKK-related activists and supporters in Diyarbakır. So now we can see that actually there is this tension between the PKK and Hezbollah that can lead a big danger and kind of a rehearsal of 1990s political violence.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about the difference in social background, the difference between PKK sympathizers and Hezbollah sympathizers, because as I gather reading the book, you talk about how Hezbollah has been a kind of magnet for a lot of less educated locals in the southeast who are kind of attracted by its less theoretical side and its more kind of action-based, let's say, ideology. Could you just talk a bit about this difference between the kind of social profile of PKK sympathizers and Hezbollah sympathizers, both during the 1990s and today in their various forms?
I mean, the social profile as Kurdish region is the poorest part of Turkey. So we can do a social profiling between two groups, but we cannot say that all less educated people support Hezbollah where better educated people support PKK. You can see similarities between groups and differences between groups. It's generally true that Hezbollah members, especially at the beginning, were more from countryside, living in villages and small places. But later they expanded their networks, and now they have, especially after the legalization of their activities, they have more urban face. But also the Kurdish countryside, after the displacement issue, basically lost that ground. Most of Kurdish people live in the cities at the moment. And at the same time, the division between the PKK and Hezbollah, to some extent, was a result of local tensions. For example, a village or a tribe supporting the PKK and a former enemy of that tribe or that village or some people who had disagreements with those people transformed into Hezbollah membership in the process. Vice versa, for the PKK, it's true as well. It also clarifies the alliance between the PKK and the Turkish state, for example, being a village guard or supporting the PKK. So we can see the transformation of these local tensions, historical tensions, transforming into political alliances in the process. I would say that there is a significant Zaza Hezbollah members as a result of some active Zaza leaders of Hezbollah in 1990s. But also we can see that, for example, Hezbollah is very strong in Batman, in the city of Batman. And it's the result of Hüseyin Velioğlu and his basically tribal network in the area, being from the region and basically being originated from that region, has affected the membership profile and huge support in that area. Another city that we can mention is Bingöl, the Zaza Bingöl. So we can see like all of these different dynamics playing a role in terms of the political alliances with the PKK and with Hezbollah. But as I said at the beginning, it's not a kind of a clear division that we cannot claim that all Zaza people are supporting Hezbollah or have a tendency to support Hezbollah. As we know, Sunni Zazas, I mean, like in the city of Bingöl, there is also a significant part of Zazas who support the Kurdish political movement as HDP or BDP.
I want to talk about the research process for the book as well, because the book is full of very vivid first-hand accounts from former members of Hezbollah. Some of them are regretful, some are defiant, but it's obviously very difficult to get access to these people, and we don't really hear these kind of voices very much elsewhere. How difficult was it to find your contacts, and what was it like as an experience trying to get them to speak to you in confidence for the book?
Of course, I had many difficulties to reach these people, but once basically when I have found some people through some connections or some references, I didn't really state that I want to talk to them right away and do an interview like a journalist would do. But instead, I allowed them to know me, to know my intention, to know what I am doing, and to know a bit about my personality. So visiting them in their in their workplace, having tea with them, talking about general situations about their life and so on and so on. So basically the process of building rapport with these people has consumed a lot of time, I would say. But at the end, I would say I was successful maybe to be able to speak to 50% of people I have reached, and still 50% of them were happy to know me and to have a tea with me, but they didn't prefer to talk. And obviously, these are untold stories, unheard stories, as these people do not have a space to share their experience, especially the former members of Hezbollah who regret about their participation of Hezbollah. They are in a great confusion. Basically, they think that their life is wasted. They could do better choices. They could make better choices. They could engage with more useful activities. They could have a life, and so on and so on. And of course, it created a big issue in terms of their social engagement with the rest of society. So they feel stuck in a certain circle, I would say. And obviously, some of them has gone through a bigger trauma, and some of them became ultra secular. I have heard that some of them have more sympathy for Christianity. And obviously, I know many of them who became an atheist in the process and they lost their belief. Yeah.
And another original and very interesting parts of the book, which a lot of people will not know about, I actually don't get to address this in the review, sadly, but I think it's really fascinating. It's this issue of novels and short stories and fiction that's written by Hezbollah members. It turns out that there's a huge amount of this kind of fiction that's been written in the Southeast about their experiences, and kind of lightly fictionalized, but basically it's describing very recognizable real-life activities. And this fiction was kind of circulated within the group by members. And you read a lot of this material during the research. Could you just talk about that aspect a bit?
So, as you said, it's a bit fictionalized, but basically it's based on their perception of what has happened in the past. And it's a reflection on the humanistic experiences of these people, the individual experience of these people. They have started to write these novels and short stories after they legalized their activities. And some writers are prisoners, basically. It's a great reflection to see what has happened and how they perceive what they perceive about their past, but also about what they include in the narrative and what they leave out. As in most of these novels, basically violence is not vivid. It's not there as the way it was there in 1990s. But at the same time, these are basically useful material to mobilize people, as Hezbollah has benefited from religious novels and stories to recruit people in 1990s. And most of these texts were written by other Islamist people, mostly Turkish people. But Hezbollah basically now is using their material, their writers, their stories, their novels, to tell about their past to younger generations who didn't experience 1990s or 1980s, and basically to recruit people through this narrative of the Islamic cause and devotion and sacrifice. And these texts are, I would say, I really enjoyed reading them to see the perception of other people, for example, how they perceive PKK or Jews, how they perceive secular people, what they think about leftist people or secular people, and how they describe themselves. And as you can see, basically, they kind of demonize the other, but when it comes to them, it's basically a big, it's kind of angel-like personalities who devote their life for the cause. But at the same time, I think it's very interesting to see that although the presence of violence is strongly connected to Hezbollah's 1990s, it's excluded from their narrative in novels and short stories.
That was Mehmet Kurt. Thank you very much to him. You can read my review of his book, Kurdish Hezbollah in Turkey, Islamism, Violence and the State, at the Hurriyet Daily News. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and supporting this podcast at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Also, remember to rate or review this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page, or do both to stay updated with new episodes. Email me with recommendations, feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And finally, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Celia Jostin Kerslake, Özlem Bey Arslan, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode in a couple of weeks, thanks once again for listening. Telli manam, tellidir, tellidir amma.